be aggressive about getting good speakers. We've had a lot of help from people in doing that. And always we've had Barry standing by, ready to go at essentially a moment's notice if one of the people ends up falling through and we end up having to go to some contingency plan. Frankly, I was a little worried this year because we didn't have much of a backup for Barry. The only backup I had was Nolan's C-grade roast material for a couple of years ago. And I know what you're thinking. If he had C-grade roast material, why didn't he use it a couple of years ago? I don't know the answer to that question. So, however, we are going to be seeing Nolan on TV very shortly as the World Series, the 2010 World Series comes to air. So that'll always be fun. But you may not know that he's got another TV show in the pipeline. He's going to be doing a replacement for the At the Movie show, which is going off the air as a new movie reviewer. And I believe the tentative title is called What the Fuck Is It With These Shit-Eating Movies? I heard they've already filmed the pilot. It was only supposed to go 22 minutes of airtime, and it ended up being 45 minutes of his Badoogie Bad Beat story, so they're going to have to refilm this.
Oh, yeah, it was brutal.
But I've already got it. I've already got it in my TiVo. This is must not miss television. I pre-ordered the DVD sets. I can't wait to see this. So, anyways.
I can't wait to hear Barry.
In that case, Nolan, I've got more. Also in development with a major network as a follow-on to the a show that's appearing this fall on a major TV network, based on Nolan's famous Twitter feed, is the show Shit Nolan Says. And I heard they're in talks with Mel Gibson in the title role. I wasn't even going to go there, but you made me. Anyways, as I said before, our other speakers have come through for us over the year, and we've been very blessed by their presence. But frankly, there's always been a little sadness among the organizers when they do, because frankly, we think, well, we're glad Doyle's here, but I wouldn't have mind hearing what Barry has to say. And so now we finally get a chance to hear what Barry has to say. Barry has been a professional poker player and poker coach for many years. Professional poker player and coach for many years, whose services are available at his website. What's your website? Barry? Really? BarryTannenbaum.com. So if anybody knows if anyone needs a poker coach, go take a look there. Is that subtle enough? In any case, he's been a card player columnist for Lord knows how long, but he's generated over 150 columns, which is no mean feat. He's written one book so far, The Advanced Limit, Limit Hold'em Strategy, which I remember the title of the same way he does. It's the initials for the high school he went to. He has contributed to one other. He has spoken on poker topics many times. Three times he's been a speaker at the World Poker Player Conference, and got killer reviews at those places. He's also spoken at Escargot, and once again did a great job. He's a life master in bridge. Some folks say he plays too tight, but actually he has. I know for a fact he's ran a 30-year-long successful bluff. That was his engineering career. But anyways, I'm pleased and very proud to introduce my good friend, Barry Tannenbaum.
You know, I've always given these talks to strangers, some of whom have paid. And now I'm doing this for a bunch of friends, and it's a little different. But hello, fellow bargers. Let me try to correct a couple of things from Nick's introduction. It's with a 33-year bluff at the engineering career. And I also want to mention that I did a few seminars for, under the auspices of Poker Stars at a World Series before they were thrown out of the World Series for being a poker thing or something. I don't like to repeat topics, so I'm not going to repeat any of those seminars, so I'm going to try to come up with something new. I want to mention something before I start. Although I've already started. A few years ago, I did this World Poker Player Conference thing in Foxwoods, and when we got back to California, Linda Johnson was kind enough to invite me to repeat it at her home for the Wednesday Poker Discussion Group, because nobody showed up at Foxwoods. And I went there prepared to give my talk, and just as I was about to start, Mike Sexton showed up. And so he did about 20 minutes of material before me, and I got to observe that I was probably the only speaker around that got to have Mike Sexton as a warm-up act. So now I'm following Doyle, which is just perfect. Nothing like following Hall of Famers to really show you, you know, what really good speakers can do. I also want to acknowledge one more person. I want to thank my wonderful and perfect wife for being incredibly supportive of my poker career. This is Betty over here. Being a professional poker player is much more difficult on the family than it is on the player. Because the player just shows up and plays, and the family has to live through losing streaks and sadnesses and bad beat stories and kicking the cats and all that stuff. And, okay, I don't kick the cat. She has been with me for all that time, and I really, truly appreciate it. And now for the talk. A lot of poker is situational, and my book covers lists of things that you do to assess in this situation, what do you think of first and second and third, and how do you, you know, balance the, you know, your position versus your cards versus your opponents versus stuff. So I was thinking about that and decided that there are some things that I always do. I mean, I have some little aphorisms and things that I believe are things that aren't all that situational, although I'm sure, you know, some of you guys can argue. And so I'm going to try to talk about some of those today. This is the whole talk, so this is it. I doubt if I'm going to get through it, so you'll probably have to have me back next year. Okay, a lot of you people don't know how flop got its name. You know, it's called just a flop, and it seems like a really strange thing. But it turns out that flop was named after Linda Johnson. People don't know that, but she's called the First Lady of Poker, and that spells flop. So that's how flop got its name. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about my good friend Nick. And so this is my first point, and it was named after Nick. It's called Always Start Slowly. And this is one of the most important things for me about poker is how do you start a session? I mean, you're driving to the casino, you sit, you're thinking about all the wonderful things you're going to do. I, honest to God, once saw a guy sit down in a 10-20 no limit game, and he was shaking with anxiety. You know, he just couldn't wait to sit down in that game and get his chips in action. And was like, you know, anybody could take the under over for like two orbits before he was, you know, left the 10-20 no limit game. It's really important that when you sit down in a new game, you assess the situation you're in and start slowly. And by start slowly, I mean a lot of different things. So I'm going to talk about some of them. One of them is you should be willing to sacrifice some potential EV for some safety. Pay attention. You should be willing to sacrifice some potential EV for some safety. And that means if you, when you don't understand the situation you're really in, because you don't know the opponents, you don't know how they're reacting, you, I'm not saying when you get aces you should like muck them, but you want to play a little bit more cautiously until you know who you're up against. I recommend to a lot of people that when they enter a no-limit game, they buy in for the minimum. I know that's not macho. I know you sit there thinking, hey, I should buy in for the maximum because I want to bust these people and make the most money I possibly can right away. What you need to do is to look at the game and see who has the deep stacks and who has the short stacks. If the idiots have deep stacks, reach into your pocket, put the maximum on the table. If the tough players have the deep stacks, play short stack for a while and see if that can help your game. Because you don't need to make difficult decisions within the first 10 minutes of sitting down for a 6 or 8 hour session. It's okay to take it easy for 20 minutes or a half hour and understand how that's going to make your decisions much easier, because you're going to understand the players, you're going to understand what they're doing. Even if you've played with them before, even people you play with every day play differently every day. And they play differently depending on whether they had a fight with their wife, or whether they just got a raise, or whether or not they just took a bad beat that you don't know about because you just got into the room. It's really difficult when you're playing with strangers and you open raise with one of your swell King 10 offsuits, and you get 3-bet, and you don't know whether he's 3-betting randomly or he's one of those guys that only 3-bets with aces. If you give it some time, you might be able to notice that. The other thing about starting slowly is that it helps you not start off being a loser. I don't like, to me, and my good friend Nick disagrees with this, so I'll tell you, how wrong he is in a minute. Table image is very important. How you appear to your opponents, if you appear to be look like Chuck all the time. Let's just pretend that you're Chuck Weinstock. So you don't have to worry about your image because, you look like Chuck. Chuck projects a tight image. And people, believe that when he open raises, he has a real hand. When you start off, even if you have good hands and you play the good hands well, but you end up losing the first 3 or 4 pots, whether you show your hands down or you don't show your hands down, you look to the table like a loser. When you look like a loser, people take shots at you. They treat you like a loser. They think, oh, here's a guy I can take advantage of because he sat down with a rack of chips and now he has a stack and a half left. They may think he's unlucky, they may think he's stupid. Whatever they think, they're not thinking, whoa, this is a scary guy. I would prefer that people start by thinking I'm a scary guy, because I'm not. I make a lot of moves at a poker table, but I want to make those moves in context of an image that will allow those moves to work. If you've lost 4 pots in a row, you can't bluff. Period. You just can't. You can. You're just not going to work very well, because people are going to think you're a loser and they're going to call you. They're going to think you're desperate, whether you're desperate or not. Even if this is the right time to bluff, it's the kind of situation you always bluff in. If you've sat down and lost a whole bunch of pots, you can't bluff. One of these days we'll talk about all the other times you can't bluff, but that's one of the times you can't bluff, is if you've lost a whole lot of pots in a row. As a result, you would like to start by not losing a whole lot of pots in a row. And if that means taking slightly fewer chances, maybe laying down a couple of more marginal hands in the blind to raises some guys you don't know that you might play later in the session, you're still okay. It's not costing you a whole heck of a lot over the course of your life to make marginal laydowns in marginal situations early in your session until you know whether those marginal situations are in fact plus EV or not. I'm not suggesting you go around just chewing EV, but it really helps if you understand where you are at. In the book, I talk about manufactured image versus evolved image. And since none of you have read the book, I'm going to talk about it here. There are two kinds of images in the world. There's the kind of, we'll talk about evolved image first. Evolved image is what happens at the table when you're playing. And things happen. If you win, if you pick up aces and kings and queens and show them down, people think that you're playing good hands. You may be willing to play lots of hands, but just happen to pick up aces, kings, and queens. But your evolved image at the table at that point is that you're a strong player, you're winning hands, you're lucky, you're good, you're cool, you're handsome, whatever it is. But you look like a winning player, and people are going to give you more respect. So now you can bluff. That's good, right? If your evolved image is weak, and actually I've done this. I've actually sat down at a table, played really well, lost three or four pots in the first 20 minutes, and put in for a table change. Because all things being equal, I would rather start over than sit there with looking like a loser with these people who are going to be coming after me. It doesn't always work, but I can look like a loser at the next table too. But at least I'm giving it a shot. Manufactured image is, say, when you're in a strange city, and even though you know you're a cool player, you put on a suit and a tie and a little badge that says International Hardware Convention, and you try to sit down and look like you don't know what you're doing, which for most of you guys isn't that hard, but when you're actually trying to do that, I did this once in Reno, and I had such a good time. I don't do this because, I kind of automatically shuffle chips and it blows the image, but I actually sat there with the intent of seeing what it would be like to, look like a novice, and I did all these cool things. I would pick up two cards with both hands, study them. I would, move the cards around the board to line them up. I would turn over one card and try to scoop the pot in. I just did these things that I thought would be, would look like I was just getting started. And, worked. It went away after about a half hour when I started actually looking like I played well, no matter how stupid I look with my hands. But for a while, people gave me credit for knowing nothing. They were trying to help me out, which was so sweet. Maybe they just do that in Reno all the time. So there is this manufactured image, and a lot of people do it. They do a drunk act. Not being drunk. They do a drunk act. Where they'll come in and they'll, I've had guys sitting there looking like they could barely see straight, and they're how did I win that pot? And and then the guy actually kicked me under the table when he was going to do another move. Just to, so that somebody would be in on the gag. But most people have a sort of blend of manufactured and evolved image. You're sitting there, you're trying to look tight. The right image at poker, I want to talk about this some. Which in the book, for those of you who read the book, you can tune out for another 3 minutes, I called FUD. Which was not the guy that chases Bugs Bunny, but it's actually an old IBM term, and it stands for fear, uncertainty, and doubt. IBM used it as a marketing term to go around and just say, hey, we're IBM and they're not, and if you buy their machine, who knows what the hell will happen to you. If you buy our machine, it's an IBM, you can't get fired for that, even if it's terrible. Well, that was the marketing ploy. It was, buy our machine and it'll work great. I mean, they're still there. Where's Univac and Sperry Rand? So what you want to do is have people fear you, but you also want them to be uncertain about what you are holding, and you want them to doubt how to approach you. Okay? Fear, uncertainty, doubt. Now, if you're just an incredibly tight player, they will fear you. When you open under the gun, everybody's going to fold, and that's really cool, because now you're, your aces are going to hold up almost all the time, but you're not going to get any action. On the other hand, if you're a maniac, people will be uncertain about you, but they won't have any fear at all. What you want to do is develop a table image that's a balance of you look like a tight player, but once in a while you show them a white blackbird, so they will understand that you are unpredictable a little bit. Now, the book, which you all go out and buy at Amazon for $16.47, will explain exactly how to do that, against whom, and when. But the idea is what you want to do is sow uncertainty while being tight so that you will get action on your hands. Because that's the goal. Is, you know, some people playing, you know, they don't want action on their hands. You know, they have pocket jacks, the flop is jack 6-3, and they push that nobody can draw out on them. Hey, I don't want to lose this pot. No good. Which brings me to something I wasn't planning to talk about, which is called Be the Casino. One of the goals you have while you're playing cards is to be the casino. And by Be the Casino means that if you go downstairs and you play blackjack or roulette or magic wheel or whatever the hell that stuff is, they offer you a bad price. But they don't offer you a terrible price because they want you to take the bad price. Your job as a poker player, especially a no-limit poker player where you decide your opponent's odds, some of you I guess play no-limit, is to give them the worst price they will take, but not give them a bad price they won't take. Because if you give them a bad price they won't, if they played roulette downstairs and instead of giving you, I don't know, they give you 35-1, they give you 12-1, nobody would play. They would make more money if they get everybody to sit down, but nobody will sit down. So they have to give you what they consider the best price you'll be stupid enough to sit down at. Well, the worst price you'll be stupid enough to sit down at, which I guess these days is blackjack paying 6-5, but that's a different seminar. Okay, so the FUD thing works backwards. So, the other thing you want to assess at the table is your table FUD about your opponents. If you feel fear, uncertainty, and doubt about your opponents, it's time to get out of the game. If you look around and you're thinking, geez, I don't know what these guys are doing, I don't know how to play against them, what you want to do is reassess why you are there. You want them to fear you, you want them to feel uncertain about you, you want them to doubt how they should proceed against you. Do you know why that is?
Why
is that, Barry? Thank you, Tim. It's because people who are uncertain and doubtful play predictably. And the goal of pretty much every poker player is to drive their opponents into predictability. Because predictable people are easy to beat. If you know what they're doing, they become easy to beat. If they are going to respond a certain way to you every time, you can read the hands better, you can read the cards better, you can make better laydowns. But in order to do that, your primary focus at the table is to drive your opponents into predictability. Okay, so I'm a familiar start slowly topic. Let's try another topic. This one is called ACM, and it stands for Always Call Morons. Now, granted, it's a bit more of a limit concept, but when you are making a difficult decision and you're looking across the table, you know, whether you should call or not call, and you're looking across the table, and you have that guy classified as a moron. Make the call. Because the majority of players, there's such a thing as the Pareto principle. And I don't know what it is, but I put it in because Bill's in the front row. I think what it means is like there's some weird 80-20 rule. And my weird 80-20 rule is that 80% of the players at any given table are trying to play well as average players. They're trying to play good. They're trying to play their cards. They're trying to, you know, raise with good hands and call with draws and fold when they're hopeless. Now, they may not know, you know, all that much, but they're trying to play good. That's what average players do. They try to play well. Okay, for those of you who, you know, in the magazine business. Those people can generally be trusted because they're trying to conserve their chips and play well. So there's 20% of the people that can't be trusted. And those are really, really good players and really, really bad players. And those are the ones, unfortunately, you need to call. The good players are much harder to call because they're really, really good players, but call the morons. You may be wrong a bunch of the time. I called a guy the other day who looked to me like a moron. I had the nut flush, the board was paired, and he had queens full. He still lost all his chips in an hour, but that time he had it. One of the annoying things about poker, you can make a brilliantly correct call and still lose all your money. But anyway, that's one of my always rules, is always call morons, for those of you madly taking notes, which is nobody. Okay. I happen to like the concept of playing big hands like big hands. That doesn't sound all that clever. A lot of poker isn't all that clever, unfortunately, which is why they let me speak. But a lot of people think they should disguise their big hands. Like, you know, you get pocket aces before the flop and somebody raises and you think, well, I'll cleverly call rather than three bet because now they won't know what I have. There's two things wrong with that. The first thing is you don't get aces or big hands that often, and when you do, you really should attempt to get the money in. The second thing is that when you play big hands like small hands, you can't trust your opponents anymore. If you, say, call with aces, and now the guy comes after you, check raises or makes a big bet, you don't know whether he's making a big bet because he doesn't think you have aces or because he doesn't care if you have aces. That makes you have a difficult decision. If you play your hand by saying, look, I have aces, what are you going to do about it? Then he makes a big bet, you know what he's going to do about it. You can then actually believe that he is predictable and lay down your hand potentially, unless he's a moron. See, the whole speech ties together here, which I didn't expect. Well, if you're going to play big hands like big hands, but you don't want to become predictable, then you also need to occasionally play some small hands like big hands. And to me, that is far preferable than playing your big hands like small hands. So if you have a really good hand on the turn, don't think, oh, I better not raise because they may not call. You're right, they may not call. But sometimes they do call, sometimes they three bet, sometimes they push. If you have a big hand, the objective is to win a big pot. Don't make a little bitty teeny bet so that your opponent, you know, will get the money in. If you have a choice between with a $100 pot, betting $100 or $10, and you bet $10 and get a crying call, and you bet $10 and get a, you have to make 10 of those to make up for one $100 call. So if you bet the $100 and they fold, and you bet the $100 and they fold, you're still not doing it wrong. Because if they call twice in 20% of the time, you're making double the profit. So, when you have a big hand, get the money in. Train your opponents that when you have a big hand, you're getting the money in. So when you have a not quite so big hand and you're getting the money in, maybe you'll win that pot anyway. And maybe you won't. And if you happen to show down a small hand that you played like a big hand, what happens? You get more FUD. You get more action on your big hands. Am I an advocate of advertising? No. Never make an advertising play. Make a play that's an attempt to win money. That in your mind is an attempt to win money. But if, as it happens, the attempt to win money fails and gives you a more unpredictable image, then you can use that image to make more money later. Just bear in mind what your image is all the time. If your image is one of a very tight player, this is where Nick and I disagree, see? Because, you know, I play limits where people pay attention. And Nick plays limits where everybody's drunk and, you know, sleeping. You know, Nick plays in the games where...
You're always sleeping.
No? That's not what they tell me. Where, you know, you don't play a hand for 2 hours and then you raise under the gun and they say... But your opponents are aware, see? Because they say, oh, look, he hasn't played a hand in 2 hours. And then they call your raise with Jack 9 offsuit. Yeah, of course they get there. Otherwise, you wouldn't know they had Jack 9 on. But the objective there is that even if you are playing with somnambulant morons, they still have some vague recollection of your image. They will remember if you bet a draw versus don't bet a draw. At some level, you know, some piece of the medulla actually functions on these people, and they have some vague memory. If you're actually playing against sentient human beings, this is much more important, of course, because if you're unaware of your image, if you have a super tight image, let's say you're Chuck and you open raise and somebody three bets you who knows what they're doing, well, they don't have ace queen offsuit. Because if Chuck open raises, everybody throws away their ace queen offsuit. They know this already. On the other hand, let's say you're Nolan, and you raise with eight, and you raise under the gun. Well, people are running to, you know, re-raise you with King 10 because they know they have the best of it most of the time.
Nolan, it doesn't matter what I have. I'm
going to
get there anyway.
Now that's some bad news, Nolan. So if you're just sitting there thinking, well, I saw this guy three bet with a bad hand, and now he three bets you, and you're unaware of the fact that your image is different than the image of the guy who he three bet, you're going to get it wrong. And you don't want to get it wrong because making, you know, quality decisions wins money at poker. So you need awareness of your image, even if it's an evolved image. Even if all you picked up is Jack Deuce offsuit for 2 hours, my record is 2.25 hours of never putting a chip voluntarily into the pot. But if you're there, whether, you know, because you're just not going to play another Jack Deuce offsuit just to say you did. And now, you know, your evolved image, you know, you may think you're perfectly happy to play, you know, Queen Jack. You know the nickname for Queen Jack offsuit?
Maverick.
It's called Hawaii. Any of you know why it's called Hawaii? Thank you, Jim. It's called Hawaii because with all the money you save not playing it, you can afford a trip to Hawaii. Just bear that in mind. It's not a real good hand, okay? Side tip for poker players. Anyway, you need to understand your image to understand how people are playing against you, not just how they're playing. Okay, we'll talk about one more of these lovely things. Always have a reason. I really believe this stuff. If you make a play, This is going to sound weird to some of you, but you should know why. If you raise, you should have a reason. It's not just, I thought I had the best hand. That's not a reason to raise. It may be a reason to raise, but if you check raise, you need to have a reason to check raise. Are you check raising to eliminate opponents? Are you check raising to build a pot? Are you check raising to start a bluff? Are you check raising to get one of those inverse free cards we all love so dearly? But you need to have a reason. If someone would tap you on the shoulder and say, why did you do that? You should be able to articulate some poker-sounding reason. Not, you know, I don't like him. You know, he gave me a bad beat with King 3, so I'm going to give him a bad beat with King 3. You need to be able to articulate a poker-sounding reason why you raised or called or checked or folded or something. And that goes for every single action. If somebody raises before the flop and you call, why? What do you think you're gaining by that? You're losing relative position. It's different seminar. But why do you think, you know, why did you do that? Are you trying to attract people? Do you think the blinds play badly and you want to make sure you get them in? Is he a maniac or really good? Is he a really good player and you're calling because if you get heads up with him, he's going to outplay you 90% of the time? There are lots of good reasons to do plays, but you need to have one. You need to always have a reason for making the play you make. And if you sort of leave the table and say, you know, I did that, but I really don't know why. Well, I mean, if you're some plays, you just say, oh, my gut told me to, and then you don't have to come up with a reason. Because that's, you know, you did that, that's a good reason for you. But my gut tells me everything all the time. Mostly you're hungry. So I really try, and I try to encourage people to have a really good reason and be able to articulate it for every single play. I'm trying to isolate this guy because he's a bad player. I'm three betting because I want to create dead money from the blinds. Whatever your reason is, have a poker reason. I have one more always rule. It's phrased as never. So the never rule is never laugh at the customers. If people make really stupid plays, keep a straight face, please. Don't go, I can't believe you did that. I have friends that do, you know, I have friends that do that. You know, some guy shows down a hand and they crack up. It's bad. I mean, you know, crack up later. You know, tell the story, you know, in your poker group or something. But try to hold it down at the table. And I'm going to conclude this thing. We'll take some questions, if any of you have any left after this talk, with what I consider the quote of the year. There's a tight player in a game, and there's a lady playing every hand. So she's playing all the hands. And you know how people get when they're gambling and you're not? Well, some of you don't. But people get kind of annoyed because, you know, they think they see poker as a gambling game, and they complain you don't have enough gamble in you. So at some point the lady says to the guy, you're not playing any hands. And he says, no, I'm playing all the hands, I'm just playing them differently than you do. Okay, I wanted to tell you that's my little talk. I think that's very profound, actually. But if anybody has a question, I'll be happy to try to answer it. Hi, Patrick. One of the guys has a name I know. Great.
Well, first of all, I want to start by saying you missed a big bet by not having a stack of your books here for sale so you can sign them.
I have a stack of my books. I sold out. But if you bring them to Barge next year, the ones you buy at Amazon for $16.47, I will autograph them for only $3 a copy.
Bad beans.
Speaking of books, one of the favorite Barry Cannavon stories that I know is when you were first starting to play poker at Garden City, at 34 Holden Tate.
3-6.
At 3-4, you told the story in the Patrick's Home where it took you all to realize that the people limping in for the blind was like an ante, and you could actually fold pre-flop, right?
All right, man, that was a 1-2 game with 50 cent and dollar blinds.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And everybody put in a dollar and waited for the flop.
Okay, I thank you for correcting me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Once in a while, if somebody would raise, then we'd all put in $2 and wait for the flop. It made no sense to me, but that's what happened.
I knew what you were going to clarify. And you said that one time you made a play, and one of the people at the table said, well, that's not in the book. And you said, book? I discovered that there was things like Solansky's on Holden, blah, blah, blah. And of course, your book is something that I want to add to my library. But what other book or books would you recommend to the aspiring poker player who wants to become a better player?
That's it. Just my book. And my other book.
We have
If you're playing limits, you need to read Holden for Advanced Players. You need to read Nick's book, which I think it's still on Amazon. They have one left. What other books would I recommend?
How about the winning poker tournaments one hand at a time?
I don't play tournaments.
Oh, you play tournaments.
I don't have the stamina to play tournaments. So while I read, I read Gus Hansen's book. I like it. It was probably the easiest book to write in the history of poker. You just play a hand and then mumble into your tape recorder what you played. I wish I could get away with that. I actually come up with strategies and stuff. I think he mumbled for about a year before he won anything. But yeah, I actually like Ralph Slotboom's book. Most people don't. Hold 'em on the come. No, actually, it's Hold 'em on the come is the one I like. But I can't endorse the Pot Limit Omaha book. There's a new Hold'em book that my publisher put out that mentions me 10 times that he hasn't sent me yet. I went on Amazon and I searched for my name, and he treats me very kindly. There was one point where he says, this play doesn't look very sophisticated, but since Barry made it, it must be really good. Steiger. So, yeah, I really appreciate his perspicacity in understanding that. Patrick's story was very cool because I actually started playing 3-6 poker at Garden City after I played the 1-2 for a while and found out that the drop was all the blinds plus. So I started playing 3-6, and I'm a voracious reader. I mean, when I take up a hobby, I try to read things, but this was a long time ago and there were no good books I could find. So I was stuck reading Avery Cardoza and Jeff Rubens and John Scarney and other books that give you really terrible advice about how to play Hold'em, if they mention it at all. A lot of them are, you know, draw books. Anyway, the guy did say to me, how come, you know, what book did you find? I think I stayed in with trips against two obvious higher trips in river quads and, you know, was able to retire. But I went to the cage. They sell these books behind the Garden City cage where nobody knows they exist. And they said, we have a beginner book and an advanced book. And I said, well, I've been playing poker for a lot of years. I'll take the advanced book. And they sold me Holden for Advanced Players by Sklansky and Malmuth. So I went home and read it, and I didn't understand it. It had stuff like, you know, stealing the blinds. When the heck are you the first one in on the button? I was usually the eighth one in on the button. So I went back and I said, can I have a beginning book now? That really helped. I mean, those two books actually helped. I love Lee Jones' book, the one that I helped edit. I really like some of the Breyer and Ciffoni Middle Limit Hold'em Poker book, which I helped edit. I can, if you want, I'll write a list of the books that I like, and I'll mail them to Nick, and he can post them to the list.
Yay!
Anything else?
That covered it, thank you.
Well, the book that my publisher wants me to write is No Limit Hold'em for Limit Players. It's a good niche, but I don't like the publisher that much, so maybe I'll just write it and let somebody else publish it. Anybody here might be interested in that? Yeah.
I'm too tired.
Whether the games are tougher or not depends on when you started playing, in my opinion. Oh, I'll stand over here. I'll talk to Kenny. He doesn't give feedback. If you started playing about 10, 15 years ago or longer, when, you know, if you were playing 2040 at Binion's, or the 2040 game at the Mirage, or the 3060 game as it evolved at Bellagio, those games will raise it and take it. Most games went raise, everybody fold. Then about some of the time it went raise, everybody fold to the big blind who called. Then you'd see a flop and it would go check, bet, fold. If those were the games you got used to playing and working on beating, then today's games aren't all that bad. On the other hand, if you started playing in 2006 or 2005, a lot of people came to Bellagio and professed they were professionals in around 2005, 2006. And they were beating the games, but they didn't know how to play. They were beating the games because they, you know, anybody can beat a poker game. You ever understand that, right? Anybody can beat a poker game. You just have to go find 8 people who play worse than you and get them to play with you. If you are at, you know, 5, 6 years ago at Bellagio or, you know, Planet Poker, that wasn't hard to do. And so these nice folks developed really horrendous habits. Beating the games, because they did not understand the essence of tight, aggressive poker. They just understood that if they flopped around a little bit, they would, you know, have the best of it more or less, and they could beat the games. For those people, the games are really, really tough now. And, you know, they are definitely tougher than they were, you know, during the Moneymaker Rounders Varconi era. But this live poker, I commend live poker. Nobody drops by a card room with $500 after they finish shooting craps online.
We would if we could.
Yeah. But they do in card rooms, especially card rooms that are affiliated with casinos. Although the ones in California that are not affiliated with casinos seem to have people showing up who act like that anyway. So it's not all that bad. But live poker is still alive and well. It's not as easy as it was 5 years ago. But if you know how to beat the game, you know how to beat the game. The people who didn't know how to beat the game, were beating it anyway, are kind of scurrying away now.
Barry, I've known you a long time. Thanks for speaking, by the way. I can't imagine being a professional poker player. What's the toughest challenge you've had over your career, you know, over the years? What's the biggest? Was there ever a point where you said, you know what, I got to get a real job? This isn't gonna work.
Well, the answer to the second question is no. I have a slight advantage in that. A, I'm fairly well bankrolled for the game I play. It's one of the reasons why I'm not, you know, playing 100, 200 every day, is because I just don't want to take, you know, $10,000, $15,000 swings 5 days in a row. The toughest thing is coping with randomness. And still, look, every professional poker player has had massive losing streaks. I've been fairly lucky. My worst losing streak at 3060 was $12,000. That's 200 big bets, which is nowhere near as bad as it can get. Kenny! It's nowhere near as bad as it can get. But the hardest thing about being a professional poker player, serious, well, in addition to the family stuff, which my wife has helped me out with enormously, is to be able to absorb a a loss. You come in the fourth or fifth day, you pick up pocket kings in the second hand, you raise, you get rivered by an idiot who decided to play jack deuce offsuit, hit a deuce and river a jack, and then to play well for the rest of the session. Not to go off, not to say, I'm through with this. There was one summer when I lost like four or five sessions in a row. Betty said, how you doing? I said, well, yeah, I lost another session. I mean, there weren't horrendous losses, but they were losses. And she said, well, you know, maybe you should take a week off and regroup. And I said, I can't. I'm playing too well right now. The ability to recognize that and to take a week or two off when you're actually letting it get to you is absolutely crucial, because you see these lovely folks who are professional. We got a guy in our game who's been playing professionally for 10 years, as long as I have. And when he gets a bad beat, he gets up and walks for 20 minutes. Now, if I did that, I would never play. So I have to. I've learned to absorb that stuff. Congratulate the guy on being a perceptive player, and move along. But that really is hard, because sociopaths would make the best poker players, but I'm not one. I have these feelings, and I want to hurl my drink at them and stuff. Or get even, or, make a stupid... When I first started playing the 3-6 stuff, I did what I thought was a very clever route. I did a tilt play. When I took a really bad beat and I started getting all this angst, I did a tilt play. Which meant that, sometime in the next two orbits, I would pick up some moronic hand like 7-5 offsuit and play it like aces, and normally lose, and then I'd say, okay, good, that's out of my system, I'll go back to playing good now. Well, it worked, but it's not very professional. Actually, amazingly enough, and I just mentioned this, I used to get these really horrendous feelings in the pit of my stomach when I took what would be considered a bad beat. One of these days we'll have a conversation about why there's no such thing as a bad beat, but when I would take what I perceived to be a bad beat, one day, the feeling went away. And I lost a pot that I, clearly deserved to win by, virtue of being me. And the feeling wasn't there. It was like, well, this is just a routine part of business. Some days customers show up, some days they don't. It's sort of like, the Be the Casino concept. If you walk down and sit at a craps table and win $100,000, they give you room and put your picture on a billboard. They don't get angry at you. As long as, maybe they get angry at you. Well, go shoot craps for a few years and see if they still get angry at you.
They love me.
Everybody loves you, Bingo. There was another hand up somewhere.
Your statement about always having a poker reason for every play, this doesn't apply for reindeer games tonight now, does it?
There is no poker reason to play a reindeer game. So, yes, it does not apply. Thank you. Can I take one last one? One more. Una más. Okay. We'll let Bill, who got the front row seat...
We can't hear him.
Yeah. I guess the one thing I would pretty much disagree with you is the sort of play conservatively at the beginning, and kind of worry about your image there. I mean, I don't know. My attitude is to see how the players play. You play with them in hands, and sure, you may lose four pots in a row, but you just take out more money, you play with them. Like, is it okay to just have that attitude? It doesn't matter if they think you're a loser. You're playing well. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, my thesis is it matters because they're going to play differently against you, and they will become unpredictable, and unpredictable opponents are difficult to play. Okay, well, they may not be for you. They are for me. No, seriously, they are for me. When I have lost some pots and people are, taking shots at me, all of a sudden they're raising withdrawals, whereas they never would before. I have a much harder time, you know, coping with that, because now I'm making harder decisions than I need to make. And it's not like I'm giving up tons of money by doing this. I'm not throwing my aces and ace kings away. I'm playing those as hard as I can. I'm just trying to avoid marginal situations, not favorite situations. But yeah, I mean, there are, you know, there are other philosophies, but they gave me the microphone, so you get mine. Thank you very much, Barry. First of all, right at this point in time, there's a tournament series going on in Mesquite at the Eureka Casino, right? Hosted by Jan Fisher. These tournaments are starting at noon every day. Somebody looking for something cool to swing by on their way out of town. They want to swing through Mesquite. Tomorrow's tournament is the Paris tournament. If you're a scary loner like myself who's living in a shack, maybe that's not your cup of tea, but it's going to be no limit hold'em for the rest of the week. Those tournaments start at noon. They're